Welcome back to the program. There's an old saying that says if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. So too for American policy in the Arab world. If every problem looks like an existential threat, then perhaps it's because we often see the military as the only tool we have. In fact, as Bill Clinton famously said, it's the economy, stupid. Perhaps if we found new ways to deal with the Middle East in terms of its economics, its desire for American goods, jobs for the 60% of its population under 30, perhaps then we'd have a better outcome. Few understand this and know this region better than our guest today, David Rode. He's currently a foreign affairs columnist for Reuters and The Atlantic. He's previously been a reporter for the New York Times, where he spent 8 years covering Afghanistan and Pakistan, where he was held captive by the Taliban for 7 months. He's a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and it is my pleasure to welcome David Rode here today to talk about his new work, Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in the New Middle East. David Rode, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you here. When we look at that part of the world today, most often we see chaos, we see confusion, or at least what we think are those things. In fact, if you zero in, there are very clear fault lines, very clear internal conflicts, and things that create opportunities and things we can take advantage of.
Yes. I mean, and I see it as a sort of battle for the kind of future of the region between conservative Muslims, some of whom are, you know, armed and frankly fanatical and dangerous, and then I think more moderate Muslims. I think it's their struggle, but we can sort of be patient and adaptive and listen to these kind of more moderate forces, ask them, what should we do here? You know, should we do nothing? Would economic aid help? They may need, you know, security, you know, assistance and training in some places. But slowing down, you know, not seeing it as chaos and trying to work through local allies, I think, is much more effective.
The danger of that, of course, is all the corruption that we have seen along the way. How do we work our way around those problems?
I think we try to do less, and the corruption exists. There's been the great reporting by one of my former colleagues at the New York Times this week about Hamid Karzai getting bags full of cash delivered to him by the CIA. I don't think that approach has worked very well. We've made a lot of mistakes in Afghanistan. I think Karzai's done a terrible job of cracking down on corruption. So it's, you know, we really, literally, and this is, you know, I try to be sort of, you know, to be down the middle on this, the conservative critique of throwing money at problems is a correct one when it came to, you know, the civilian effort in Afghanistan and Iraq. We were really, I talked to these very committed American civilians. You know, there's been a lot of books about the military effort and the intelligence effort post 9/11. I wanted to write about the civilians that were over there trying to create stable economies and effective governments and, you know, fair justice systems. And they were really trapped in a dysfunctional aid system that was all about creating, you know, metrics that would impress members of Congress, spending, you know, whatever amount had been given the administration, whether it was the Bush administration, the Obama administration, sort of as quickly as possible. And we ended up wasting a lot of money building. There's a report today by a special inspector that in Afghanistan we've built at least two very modern hospitals that they can't really maintain there. And it's we need to slow down and again try to do less development-wise, but do it over longer periods, work through more NGOs on smaller projects instead of doing everything in this huge scale that only private contractors can really handle.
What about that effort? The fact that so many of the things that we have tried to do, or the few things we've tried to do, there's been this movement to privatize, to bring them under the guise of military contractors in many cases.
It's a bipartisan achievement. It started under Bill Clinton and Al Gore, actually, in terms of reinventing government. And it's this, you know, real, we're happy in Washington to increase the size of the U.S. military, and I know there's criticism of the U.S. military. What struck me, actually, again, in spending time on the ground, was as an institution, the U.S. military is pretty effective because it invests in its people. It trains them. It creates a sort of can-do culture, and they have their excesses. But it's an impressive thing in a sense. And then you go to the civilian side, and it's, you know, there was an increase of about, it was 30% increase in spending by the U.S. Agency for National Development, primarily in Afghanistan and Iraq under Bush, but there was no increase in the number of staff that was supposed to manage this torrent of money, billions of dollars that was supposed to be spent in those two countries. So the thinking is you privatize it, that it's more efficient, you have competition among contractors. And what I found was that there was many cases where there wasn't competition because very few companies would bid for very dangerous work in Afghanistan. And then Wall Street saw the profits that were being made here. And just one specific example, the largest State Department contractor is a company called DynCorp International. They started out as an aviation maintenance firm based in Texas, and they realized there was this very lucrative market to basically provide personnel for these temporary missions around the world, and then they were perfectly positioned when 9/11 happened. DynCorp received $7 billion from the State Department to send hundreds of American civilians to train police in Iraq and Afghanistan. A Wall Street firm called Veritas Capital saw this, bought DynCorp, took it public, and then sold it to another Wall Street firm, and Veritas made $350 million on the deal.
In many ways, we see the corruption, although it may be a very different kind, but the corruption is on both sides, both our side and over there.
That's exactly what one Afghan who worked for this contractor said. You know, and let me be fair, you know, when it comes to building roads, there are private companies that do it better than, you know, an American government bureaucracy. But, you know, when it comes to training teachers and reforming health care, you know, NGOs, you know, you should see which group is best positioned to do the job best. But I did have this Afghan say to me, you know, it's corrupt on both sides, just as you said. For us, it's kind of, you know, he talked about the Afghans getting kind of bags of cash and that the Americans make their money in high overhead and salary rates. And he literally said to me, for you, it's white-collar crime, and for us, it's blue-collar crime.
How much of this is really our impatience with looking for solutions? In many ways, if we look, as you talk about, we look at Afghanistan, we see that there has been some progress in health care and a number of other areas, but it's been small, it's been incremental. We keep looking for these silver bullet kind of solutions.
Yeah, and I would say healthcare has been more positive, and I'll just talk about that because I think it's an interesting example. There was a decision by the Afghans. There was good leadership in that ministry. You saw in Afghanistan a good minister could make a difference, and some ministries perform much better than others. So really early in 2002, the Afghan health officials developed a strategy, and they were, you know, asked, do you want, you know, big hospitals, this modern system? And the strategy was, no, we're going to build a system of small health clinics that are across the country so that every Afghan is within one day's walk of a health clinic. And then they had different, and it was, I think, almost all NGOs, each province, the reform, this new health system, was run by a different NGO in each province. And that system has really worked. It's decreased the amount of mothers dying in childbirth. You know, child mortality has improved. Overall mortality has improved. And that was sort of, these projects can work. I mean, you know, there are, really are gains in terms of health, things that the Gates Foundation is doing or the Clinton Global Initiative. You know, there are real improvements around the world in development, and we need to use more of those with more local buy-in, more listening to locals, and a slower pace if we really hope to achieve anything.
Can we do this within the current framework, or do we have to rethink what we're doing on the military side as well and take a look at the drone programs and all the other things that we're doing in order for these other aspects to work?
I think that there, and again, I'm trying to sort of be down the middle here, I was kidnapped by the Taliban and held captive for 7 months in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and that's where these drones are used. And, you know, there are some of these jihadists that are dangerous, not just to us, but they're killing moderate Muslims. The young woman, she's, you know, on the cover of Time magazine, Malala Yousafzai, she's a 15-year-old Pakistani girl who was shot in the face by the Taliban for trying to attend school. So I think you need to have some drone strikes in these remote areas where the Pakistani army will not confront the Taliban, but they should be minimized. They should be made public. They should be handled by the American military, and sort of the international laws of war should apply. You know, if we should release the videos, say who we're trying to kill. If there are reports of civilian casualties, they should be investigated, and, you know, compensation should be paid. The military has a system for this. It's not perfect. But the current approach of this sort of absurdity that these are secret strikes, you know, we're just getting, you know, lambasted in terms of public perception in these countries. I think civilians are killed, but it's not, you know, the vast majority of people killed are not civilians. But in the way we're going about this, it's very, I think, self-defeating.
What's interesting in terms of some of these economic programs is that there are things that we have talked about in terms of policy. Hillary Clinton had talked about economic statecraft, and of course the late Richard Holbrooke, who you talk about a lot in the book, saw a lot of these problems inherent in the situation over there. And yet, even within that framework, we've done very little in these economic areas.
It's interesting because, you know, George W. Bush launched this massive government initiative, PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and it saved at least a million lives in Africa. The Millennium Challenge Corporation, you know, created incentives for countries to get aid, you know, and there is agreement on it, but we're sort of paralyzed in Washington. And you know, and the administration, you know, blames the far right, and I think that's, you know, part of the problem, that there are certain things that no matter what the administration does, they're not going to support. But I did hear, you know, complaints. Secretary Clinton proposed a roughly $500 million incentive fund for the post-Arab Spring Middle East last year. It was, you know, was not approved by Congress. But there were moderate Republicans and Democrats who said that the administration didn't spend enough time on the Hill, didn't talk enough to staffers, didn't talk enough to kind of centrist Democrats and Republicans to get this kind of thing through. My concern is that, you know, again, Washington is just broken. And, you know, even if Mitt Romney had won, it's such trench warfare now that Romney, whatever one thinks of his ideas, wouldn't have been able to implement them, you know, because, you know, we are just so partisan that we, you know, the government's frozen.
One of the worst examples of this, or perhaps one of the most ironic, is what's gone on in terms of investment in Palestine, that Israeli entrepreneurs are putting funds together to make investments, and yet if America tried to do this, if we tried to do it as an instrument of policy, it would be shot down immediately.
You're absolutely right. I interviewed Yadin Kaufman. He's an Israeli venture capital investor, and he has created a fund that is just for promoting high tech in the West Bank. And President Obama, to his credit, on his recent trip, talked about the 100 high tech firms that exist on the West Bank. And again, an effort by Clinton to modernize the State Department. She appointed a chief innovation officer, a young guy named Alec Ross. He's now out of the administration. He said he felt they made progress in terms of innovation, but he's convinced that the best way to marginalize Hamas and kind of counter radicalization of the Palestinians is, you know, jobs for these young kids on the West Bank. And Kerry is planning to announce, it's not clear when he's going to do it, but he's requesting about $300 million in economic aid, primarily for the West Bank. And he has said that he's hoping a better economic atmosphere will help move peace talks forward. There's huge political issues that obviously block a peace agreement, but you know, the administration is trying on that front.
Does the economic success of Turkey provide any lessons for us in the region?
I think it does. And let me first talk about the positive side of Turkey, which is there was a long-running effort in the 90s and then in the 2000s where Turkey was making all these economic and political reforms and human rights reforms to become part of the European Union. In the end, that didn't happen, but the Turks don't really care because the Turkish economy is now growing faster than any economy in Europe. They've developed a very large middle class. This would be people that sort of have a house or an apartment. You know, they're able to buy refrigerators and cars and televisions, And, you know, it's a big success economically. A lot of foreign investment by American and European firms has come in. So the economic model worked. And again, it's creating incentives and then having local leaders implement these reforms themselves, not, you know, Paul Bremer coming in and bringing these things out. And if a country doesn't want to implement these reforms, they don't have to. It's sort of a carrot situation where they can get these kind of agreements and investments and aid, but they don't have to. And then, but I want to be honest about Turkey. Prime Minister Erdogan, the current leader, has been, you know, totally gratuitous in his crackdowns on his opponents in the press and in academics, and it's enormously frustrating to me and many people. He's a genuinely popular leader, but he's just very intolerant of dissent. So I will not say that, you know, Turkey in terms of democracy is some great example for the region. It could be. His behavior, you know, could change things for the better, but I do think it's an example in terms of economics.
As we look at economic development, talk about something like the Little America Project and what we can learn from something like that.
There was a really a long-running project in southern Afghanistan in a town called Lashkargah was the Afghan name, and the United States had aid workers there for like 30 years during the Cold War, and I met an American who visited it during the Cold War. His name was Chuck Grader, and he was the last head of the U.S. Agency for International Development's office in Afghanistan before the Soviets invaded. I met him in 2004, and we went down to Helmand, to Little America, to see what it looked like 40 years later. And there was this huge expectation among Afghans that the U.S. was somehow going to recreate this big project. We had built a lot of irrigation canals and dams and roads in the Cold War. And many Afghans were totally sort of unimpressed with the post-9/11 effort compared to the Cold War effort. We had all these contractors. Grader himself was a contractor. That was the only way he could sort of find work there. And they just found the post-9/11 effort more superficial. There was a sense that the Americans were there to make money for themselves, not to really help Afghans. And let me say, I'm not suggesting that we create a 1960s-style USAID, you know, full of, you know, a massive organization full of engineers and agronomists. But again, if there's more people in USAID to develop strategies, to write contracts or grants, you know, for what we do and then what we want done, and then to monitor their implementation. Again, smaller contracts would be much more effective, where we could work with NGOs and smaller, maybe Afghan for-profit businesses directly and achieve more and listen more. And again, we will achieve more by trying to do less over longer periods.
One of the other economic areas you talk about is the degree to which we should be thinking about this region and its 1.5 billion people as a market for U.S. goods, as an opportunity for trade and economic development.
Absolutely. I think that people don't really see it that way. And one of the statistics that surprised me in this recent talk given by this the State Department official who was talking about trade was that the U.S. now export more to the United Arab Emirates, essentially the area, the country where Dubai is. We export more to the UAE than we do to all of India. And that's because, you know, American companies are very good at infrastructure. You know, there's a huge amount of building going on there. We're very good at energy, and we're very good at, you know, finance and tech. So we could be, I think, selling more to the region. You know, we should also be selling more to China and India, and it'll help. I think there's a beneficial relationship possible where we're creating jobs in the U.S. and creating trade with these countries and more normalized relations. You've talked about Holbrooke, and he was very focused in Pakistan on creating a more normal relationship with Pakistan, where the United States cared about the long-term stability and prosperity of Pakistanis. And the problem is that it's all become about terrorism, and it's viewed by the Pakistanis as a transactional relationship where we only care about Pakistan or Yemen or any place if there are militants there, and we're just sort of giving, you know, the Pakistani army military aid so we can carry out our drone strikes. And people see that in the region. So, again, maybe I'm too idealistic, and again, I'm not saying this is going to solve all our problems, but a more patient, diplomatic-focused, economic-focused, you know, normalized approach to this region and its stability, I think is going to serve us more than these massive, you know, military efforts or the illusion that we're just going to deal with all of this through drone strikes.
And as you talk about, and as Holbrooke even talked about at the time, there is a desire on the part of large groups in the region for modernity, for American consumer goods to be part of modern life.
Yeah, it's funny. There's really two Afghanistans. I think listeners will find this very hard to believe, but Kabul and cities tend to be much more modern, whereas the countryside in Afghanistan is much more conservative and rural. But, you know, my, you know, Afghan friends, and they're sort of members of the elite, to be honest, but they have iPhones. One of the most popular programs in Afghanistan is Afghan Idol, which is the Afghan version of American Idol. And the reality there, though, is that there's a young woman who was competing on Afghan Idol, but she had received death threats because she was sort of singing in public. And that's this tension between these two Afghanistans. I think we, you know, should see what happens in Afghanistan. I'm hoping, again, a new leader will be in there instead of Karzai. We should continue funding their security forces for the, you know, first several years after the U.S. leaves, which is much, much cheaper than having American troops on the ground, and see if, you know, this more moderate Afghans fight. They say they will. They think that once American troops are out, the Taliban will lose support because there isn't the kind of bogeyman of foreign troops. Again, you know, work through allies, be patient, and trust them that they know best how to sort out these problems. They know best how to kind of marginalize militants, you know, not American soldiers.
And with respect to the moderates, as you point out, that American troops certainly aren't popular, but the extreme fringes of the Taliban aren't very popular either.
And that's what you don't hear in the American media, and again, I'm a member of the media. You know, the Al-Qaeda has killed more Muslims than it has, you know, Christians or, you know, members of any faith. There was intercepted letters where Osama bin Laden was begging the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq to stop killing, you know, other Muslims in Iraq. And it did make Al-Qaeda unpopular. This is, you know, part of the sort of success that occurred in terms of the U.S. troop surge. It was partly the U.S. troop surge, but it was that Sunnis in Iraq turned against Al-Qaeda because they were so brutal, and I think we forget that. That doesn't mean that people like Americans as a result, but, you know, again, it's this idea of a third way, that they don't want to be, that there's something more than being American puppets or, you know, being ruled by jihadists.
Why have we had such a hard time understanding and being able to see and realize that there are moderates in the area?
Look, I think that the 9/11 attacks were devastating, and it was a tremendous sort of blow to the country psychologically. I think particularly later on, you know, President Bush was very criticized for using the term crusade. You know, I think he since admits regretting that. And I think he and President Obama both tried to make it very clear this is not, you know, a war against the faith. In the wake of the Boston bombings, you know, I think the worst thing that people can do is sort of blame all Muslims for those attacks. There was this plot in Canada with a train, which was, you know, it was foiled because Muslims in Canada who were around these suspects reported what was happening to police, and that's happened in many cases in the U.S. So it's hard, and all we see in the media is attacks and terrorism. Saudi Arabia, where women can't even drive, you know, is seen as this example of Islam. There's many more interpretations of Islam. There's countries in the region that are much more modern than that. So I get, you know, the difficulties and the frustrations of Americans. And we've had a hard time seeing this before. And frankly, these guys are very effective. You know, you one bomb in Boston has set back. I had some, you know, setback, I think, efforts by Muslim Americans to try to feel more integrated. I mean, the morning the brothers were identified, I happened to be with a Pakistani doctor, and he was just crushed and hated the bombings, but worried that years of effort in his community in Louisville, Kentucky, would be set back by this bombing.
And yet the greatest threat to America's security, as you point out, is sort of the overarching idea, is the economic problems and stagnation in the region.
It is, and I get the, you know, and the greatest threat in a way is also American economic stagnation, and I completely understand the reluctance to spend money on this. I just think we spent a huge amount on military operations, and if we were to not increase our spending but shift some of our spending to these, you know, these programs to promote entrepreneurship. One interesting program that I found out about was it's a post-Arab Spring effort. It came out of the president's speech in Cairo, where he talked about a new beginning with the Muslim world. And it's a State Department program that sends high-tech American investors and executives to the region. And there was one guy, a Tunisian-American named Sami Ben Ramdani, and they went to three countries in North Africa, Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria. And in each country, young people came and met this delegation of Americans, and there was a competition over who would present the best idea for a new high-tech startup. And in Tunisia, the winner was actually a young woman who proposed a biotech startup that would, you know, create jobs, and it was this great meshing of technology and the U.S. and all these things. But the members of this delegation, the Americans, were sort of horrified when they realized this program was so poorly funded, there was no State Department prize for the winning business idea. So the members of the delegation pooled their money together. Some of them were Arab Americans from Detroit. And so this young woman was given a 3-month internship in the Tech Town incubator in Detroit, Michigan. And frankly, we've got to do better than that. If we think we're going to kind of help stabilize this region and, you know, counter jihadists, you know, that's not an expensive program. And that's a smart, innovative idea to kind of have contact and spread ideas in the region. You know, we've got to do this. I talked to an Egyptian who runs a high-tech incubator in Egypt, and he said, you don't even have to send the delegations. Give my young tech people in Egypt, you know, let them do presentations by phone to potential American investors, you know, once a month. And maybe they'll all fail, but then at least they can get feedback from, you know, American tech people about how to pitch their ideas and come up with better ideas for new companies.
David Rode, his new book just out from Viking is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. David, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. I'll be right back.